from David Rutledge. Welcome to the Earshot podcast. And we have music and poetry coming up for you. Kicking off with Sinead Morrissey. She's currently reader in creative writing at the Seamus Heaney Centre in Belfast, where she's also the city's first ever poet laureate. Now, I have to confess, I've never been a huge poetry reader, but I love hearing poetry read, and I particularly love hearing Sinead Morrissey read her own work. She has a soft but intense style, which I'm sure you'll agree is quite compelling. Her poems take in intimate themes, such as family and motherhood, but she also draws on historical material, adopting different voices for dramatic effect. Here's producer Fiona Kroll talking with Sinead Morrissey about her latest collection, Parallax.
Your recent book of poetry, Parallax, it won the T.S. Eliot Prize, and it sure does adhere to the meaning of that word, parallax, many-angled, any-angled. Of course, your many themes in the book traverse history, memory, landscape, ageing, motherhood. Lots of references to paintings, heaps to photographs. That really stands out for me. Yeah. And a load more. But what does the word parallax mean to you in relation to your poems?
I suppose it means acknowledging that what we know by virtue of where we stand. So what we know is endlessly questionable, I suppose, because if you stand in another place, the thing that you're looking at changes slightly.
Let's hear a lie from Parallax. And if you could just set it up for the listener before you read it.
Well, as you say, a big theme in Parallax is ekphrasis, you know, writing to a visual image of some kind, but particularly photographs and particularly old photographs. A lie, it's really thinking about the way in which photography was a falsification of the world. And when it came about, it was deemed to be so much more true or authentic than, say, impressionist paintings. Because I think early photographers, particularly ones with a social quest, they said implicitly in their photographs, this is true, this is happening, this is this moment stopped in time. But of course, what they did was turn a world in colour into a world in black and white. And my son said to me once, Mummy, is it true that in the ancient days, everything happened in black and white? And I think that subconsciously, that is an assumption that we carry about the past. So this poem is about how that's not true. A lie. That their days were not like our days, the different people who lived in sepia. More buttoned, colder, with slower wheels, shut off, sunk back in the unwakeable house for all we call a knock. And even the man with the box and the flaming torch who made his servant stand so still their faces itched, can't offer us what it cost to watch the foreyard being lost to cream and shadow, the pierced sky placed in a frame. Irises under the windowsill were the colour of ancient Rome.
The girls alone, I build my hair, they sew my coat, and that's all right till I go home. She is handsome, she is pretty, she is a belle of Belfast City. She is curled in 1, 2, 3, please won't you tell me who is she?
Now, I'm speaking to you from Belfast, Sinead, and of course you were born in 1972 in Northern Ireland, but not in Belfast, but that was before the peace process. I'm interested to hear a bit about your background. You know, I don't come across many people that had parents that were card-carrying communists. I'm keen to hear about what your upbringing was like, perhaps before you read the poem The Doctors.
Yes, so my parents were very active in the Communist Party of Northern Ireland, which was an extremely fringe activity in Northern Ireland. There weren't very many people in the party. And of course, this was during the Troubles. So Northern Ireland was fiercely divided politically along sectarian lines, which in a way made their position even more fringe. So I would be brought as a child to many Communist Party meetings on a Saturday morning, and my parents would stand in Corn Market in Belfast and sell copies of Unity. And then I would go to all kinds of fundraising activities and marches and CND days, all of that kind of thing. And in some ways, I think this was a brilliant way to be brought up. They instilled fantastic principles in me about not only non-sectarianism, but non-prejudice. That was very deep-seated. I think it was looking at things from another angle. And then as I grew up, I mean, there was an unquestioning loyalty towards the Soviet Union, which I believed. So during the Cold War, the Americans were always the bad guys in my family and the Russians were the good guys. And then as I grew up, I started to read histories of Russia, became very interested in this subject. And I was very shocked initially to discover the differences between the view of the Soviet Union that I had as a child and the reality of what had gone on really in that country. So the poem The Doctors is looking at one of the worst periods in Soviet history, which was the 1930s under Stalin, and the practice of doctoring photographs. So there was a ministry established under Stalin in the 1930s specifically for this purpose. And as people fell out of favor with the regime and were either assassinated or sent to the gulag, they had to be eradicated as well from the aesthetic historical record. So any photographs that had them in it had to be changed so that they would be removed. And because so many people were killed by Stalin, anybody with whom he was photographed would eventually be airbrushed, be doctored out of the image. So this poem is about that process. The doctors, in this country, they are desecrating photographs. Those that tell the truth of their own flown moment, simply as it was. That are naive as schoolchildren, set down in a bewildering classroom and bid to speak their name and place of birth in a foreign tongue, who revert instinctively to their own, as slits and straps and canes rain down upon them. It is the camera's inherent generosity of outlook, which is more often than not at fault. The one whose name we dare not whisper, sitting at breakfast with our great leader on holiday in the Urals, or idly grinding his teeth in a dim committee room, his glasses like miniature headlights reflecting the flash. With scissors, nail files, ink and sellotape, he has been vanished, alongside other party operatives who touched his sleeve or didn't clap for long enough or loved their wives or laughed, or who pointed the way down some rickety steps as though he needed help. Whole politburos cropped to a man, or at most a handful of survivors ranged around a chess table, scratched absences over their shoulders made luminous as moons. It is addictive. The urge to utter a language both singular and clean. It is progressive. How the power to transform a conspirator into a pillar transmutes in turn to the eradication of the accidental as a class of photograph. How litter, bleak weather, a sneer, or too many smiling parents who later disappeared are also doctored. And should anyone be missed, turning up in textbooks before the grave extent of their transgressions been established, a nation's girls and boys, all trained in proper parlance, their fingers stained with soot, draw over women's faces black balloons.
Under the title The Doctors in your book, there's a wee quote there. Blurted it out like a Polaroid, Paul Muldoon. I'm interested to stay with Paul and that clutch, I guess, of those Northern Irish names that you must have been brought up with, Seamus Heaney, maybe even Tom Paulin. These names, they're giants of Irish poetry. Do they inform your work, or how do you deal with such an inheritance now that you're the you know, the poet laureate of Belfast. Do you think about these people, the Seamus Heaneys?
Yeah, I think about them all the time. I don't think you can help thinking about them and engaging with their work. But I don't find it a very heavy burden, and I don't feel antagonistic towards those great bodies of work. I just feel grateful that they're there, really. And I read a lot of other poets too, so they join with the poets that I read to who are my teachers, I suppose, but they are particularly close to me because they're often writing about this place where I am as well, and writing into that space. So it's a particularly intimate connection.
And speaking of Tom Paulin, when I spoke to him maybe about a year ago, he was saying that, you know, since the peace treaties come in, of course, the whole vibe has changed. He said, don't get me wrong, of course, the peace agreement's fantastic. It's a wonderful thing. But he felt there was less for him to draw upon. Where do you sit on that?
Well, I haven't really ever used the Troubles directly as a source. And part of that is that these great poets who've come before me have done that so brilliantly that I've kind of shied away from going into that territory in the first place. I mean, I think that some of the elegies that Michael Longley has written out of the Troubles just are so, they're so grand and towering. You know, it's impossible to emulate that kind of authority and that sort of moral achievement that's in those poems.
Ceasefire. Put in mind of his own father and moved to tears, Achilles took him by the hand and pushed the old king gently away. But Priam curled up at his feet and wept with him until their sadness filled the building. Taking Hector's corpse into his own hands, Achilles made sure it was washed and, for the old king's sake, laid out in uniform, ready for Priam to carry, wrapped like a present, home to Troy at daybreak. When they had eaten together, it pleased them both to stare at each other's beauty as lovers might. Achilles built like a god, Priam good-looking still and full of conversation, who earlier had sighed, I get down on my knees and do what must be done and kiss Achilles' hand, the killer of my son.
In terms of writing of the dislocated city of Belfast and its disrupted geography and its disrupted languages and history, then, you know, Kieran Carson is the poet par excellence. And he's done that so fantastically that I don't feel drawn to going into that territory really in the first place. So I don't feel that a source of poetry has been removed from me at all. And you know, I was away from Northern Ireland for almost 10 years. And while I was away, the Good Friday Agreement happened. I was actually living in New Zealand when the Good Friday Agreement happened. I feel that my second association with Belfast when I came back to live here with my American husband is the one that I'm really drawing on now for my writing materials. And that is, without question, a city in peace.
You said earlier that you were brought up in a family that thought, you know, the Soviet Union was the place. You know, that was the one to look towards. Let's move on to another poem in Parallax, Puzzle. That certainly draws upon some sort of theme of the Soviet Union.
Oh, yes, absolutely. My friend lent me this fantastic book. I've dedicated the poem to her, Sheila Llewellyn. In the book, it's opposite a poem about the first ever jigsaw puzzle. And I was telling my friend, oh, I'm writing a poem about the first ever jigsaw puzzle. And she said, oh, I have a fantastic book about puzzles. So she lent me the Moscow Puzzle Book, which has been translated into English. The Moscow Puzzle Book was published in the Soviet Union in the early 1950s and was a runaway success. And what it is a book of mathematical puzzles. So these are very, very difficult conundrums that you're supposed to be able to solve in your head. And it's that, but it's also a lesson in how to be a good Soviet citizen. So what fascinated me about the book was that the puzzles are couched in such overtly ideological terms. They tell you how to be as well as give you a problem to solve. And I was interested in the finishedness, I suppose, of the Soviet project and how that flag came down on Christmas Day 1991. And it seems in many ways to be a project that is irrevocably over. You know, at the time of the Berlin Wall came down, there was all that kind of dialogue around the end of history and all of that. So this poem kind of pitches the vibrancy of the Soviet project against its redundancy. Puzzle for Sheila Llewellyn. Vitya pledges his brigade of pioneers will plant half as many fruit trees as the other pioneers. Kiryusha pledges his brigade, the best of the detachment, will match the trees of all brigades together, including Vitya's. Their brigades work the last shift simultaneously. The preceding brigades of the detachment plant 40 trees. Both pledges are fulfilled exactly. How many trees does the whole detachment plant? Answer: a kind of Latin, finished and intricate, or a box of glass plate negatives from 1887, unearthed by accident, of Newcastle Cloth Market. The oceanic white tip shark. Ectoplasm. Natasha Ivanova on her collective farm, working out the most efficient way to harvest cotton.
And what did Sheila think of the poem?
Oh, she really liked it. I mean, I took one of the actual puzzles in the book and put it into the first stanza. It's a Petrarchan sonnet, so within the form there's a kind of built-in problem-solution dynamic, which is why I used the Petrarchan sonnet for the poem. So the first bit is an actual puzzle from the book that I just rewrote slightly. The second bit is a list of extinct things. So the oceanic white-tipped shark is the latest species of shark to become extinct. But she liked it very much. Well, the actual answer, I wanted to tell your listeners, they may have worked this out if they are very good at maths, but the actual answer is 136.
And are you a bit of a puzzle head, generally?
No. No, I'm mathematically illiterate. I was always hopeless at maths, so yeah.
I'm glad to hear that, because I didn't want to hear that you were a brilliant literary person and a maths person.
No, not at all.
Well, take us to the waters now of Belfast through your poem Lighthouse. Mm. It's a real poem of collision in a way, I guess. Industry, yeah. Nature colliding there.
Yeah, so I wrote this for my son when he was, I think, about five. We live along the north shore of Belfast Lock, slightly outside of the city boundaries. And you can see Belfast Lock from my son's window. And he's a terrible sleeper. He doesn't fall asleep for ages. And I went in one evening and it was coming to the end of August. And I realised that he was up and looking out the window and that he had been waiting for the lights of the lighthouse across the lock to become clearly visible, and that he was doing this every night. So I wrote this poem for him. Lighthouse. My son's awake at 10, stretched out along his bunk beneath the ceiling, wired and watchful. The end of August. Already the high-flung daylight sky of our northern solstice dulls earlier and earlier to a clouded bowl. His Star of David lamp and plastic moon have turned the dusk to dark outside his room. Across the lock, where ferries venture blithely, and once a cruise ship, massive as a palace, inched its brilliant decks to open sea. A lighthouse starts its own night-long address in fractured signalling. It blinks and bats the swing ball of its beam, then stands to catch, then hurls it out again beyond its parallax. He counts each creamy loop inside his head, each well-black interval, and thinks it just for him. This gesture from a world that can't be entered. The two of them, partly curtained, partly seen, upheld in a sort of boy talk conversation no one else can hear. That private place, it answers. With birds and slatted windows, I've been there.
let you take us into your poem display.
Sure. So this poem is about the Women's League of Health and Beauty. It was a mass movement in Britain. It was founded in 1930 by a woman called Mary Bagot Stack. And by 1939, they had 1 million members. And it was basically an outdoor exercise club. The uniform was little skimpy shorts and a little skimpy satin sort of vest. And they really believed in exercise and in strength of the female body. And they believed in doing this together in large coordinated displays, which, you know, sounds quite fascistic and very much of its time. My grandmother was a factory worker in Nottingham in the 1930s. And her friend, I remember her telling me, her friend was in the Women's League of Health and Beauty. And my granny always wanted to join, but her parents wouldn't let her buy the uniform. They were really mean. So my granny never joined, but I was aware of it. And when I started to read more about it, I thought it was quite suspect. I mean, Mary Bagot Stack's rationale for founding the movement was to strengthen working class women's bodies so that they would, you know, that kind of, again, that very 1930s idea about the strength of the race, be fit for childbirth and have healthy children and all of that. And then I read more and I kind of softened towards it. And I thought for so many women, it must have been so fun and really empowering. And it was nothing to do with men. It was something that they did by themselves, for themselves. Their slogan was "Movement is life." Display. Hyde Park, 1936. Cold enough for scarves and hats among the general populace, but not for the 15,000 women from the League of Health and Beauty performing calisthenics on the grass. It could be snowing, and they of Bromley, Croydon, Slough, Glasgow, Belfast would don no more than a pair of satin knickers and a sleeveless satin vest to spin and stretch and bow the body beautiful. Athens in London under a sodden sky, and Winnie and Molly and Doris metamorphosed. On the edge of the revolving staves of arms and legs, pale as comfrey, an army not yet on the move but almost ready. There are tents for scones and tea. Kiddies brought to watch in caps and plaits wriggle on deck chairs. Their mothers carry vast forbidden handbags on their laps and smell of lily of the valley. All around the periphery, in huddled clumps of overcoats and smoke, from offices and railway yards, men joke and talk, gesticulate. But mostly they just look, quietly and sharply focused, like eyeing up the horses at a race course, but with much more choice. For those crammed in steaming picture houses later, a commentator, brusquely charmed, declares the perfection of British womanhood, to them belongs the future. While the ghost of Mary Bagot Stack, whose dream this is, smiles back. Their hair cut short, slim, coordinated as the League of German Maidens or a chorus set from Hollywood, fit for birth. The women twirl and kick, do foot swings and scissor jacks, link hands or fall suddenly flat as pegs in a collapsible building, then bounce back up again, for movement is life and they are keeping moving. To hell with it, they may as well be saying, twist. To hell with Lizzie Evans and her bitching hate, with blood and vinegar, with getting in the tin bath last, with laddered stockings, with sore wrists at the factory. I've got the fresh air body they promised me. Twist. It's electricity.
Let's end on blog, Sinead. The last the last poem in the book.
Yeah.
What do you think of the blog generally?
I am baffled by the extent to which people are living their private lives in public. I don't understand it. I don't understand Facebook. I don't understand any of it. It completely baffles and disturbs me.
Oh, the same as me. Oh, dear.
I know I'm just old, but still.
Too much detail.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. So a friend of mine told me that he'd written his sexual memoir, which just seemed like such an insane thing to want to do. You know, I didn't understand it at all. And I just had fun with this. So this is like an invented man's voice who has a blog about all his sexual exploits. I'm sure such things exist. It's not based on an actual one. But in terms of parallax, I really wanted to end the book here because it's kind of in direct conversation with the first poem, 1801, which is about Dorothy Wordsworth's diary entry. And it's so it's like 200 years later, what our diary entries look like now. And the first poem is really about how much she's in love with her brother, but she can't say it. And it's all subsumed and hidden, and you know, and now everything's just so explicit, and everything is told, and there's no subtext at all. So those two poems are in conversation. Blog. I don't have girlfriends, but I do have sex with a different woman about 3 times a month, sometimes more, sometimes less. I rarely ask. They'll stop to talk to me in the supermarket or on the bus. Offhandedly, at first. They're not made up or drunk. We don't flirt or analyse it. There's this tiny electrical thrill gets past like an egg yolk slipping between the cups of its own split shell. They take me home, it happens. I leave. Simple. They don't invite me to dinner or text. It's easy and clean and consensual. Then it happens again. Loneliness is overblown, unless I'm just one of the unnaturally blessed. My good friend Jack told me to write this down.
On RN, you've been listening to Earshot and Belfast's Poet Laureate, Sinead Morrissey, reading from her latest collection, Parallax. And Sinead was in conversation there with producer Fiona Kroll, and the sound engineer was Tom Henry. Parallax is published by Carcanet Press, and check the website for more details or leave us a comment if you like, abc.net.au/RN. Look for Earshot on the program menu.